Redbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota on Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit toyotaonnicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com.
Welcome to Triumphs and Tragedies. This is the seventh episode in a 20-part series on the history of the Catholic Church. I'm Father Dwight Longenecker. I invite you to go to my blog, dwightlongenecker.com, where I blog every day on current events and theological issues, and there's some satire and some humor there as well. And you can also listen to my podcast, Homilies, as well as Triumphs and Tragedies. If you like, you can also connect with my podcast through my iTunes channel and also through Breadbox Media and FM Player. Go to the Catholic channel on FM Player and you can bookmark these different sites and go and check out my podcasts. And they'll also send you notifications when a new one comes up. So I invite you to do that. Also, if you would like to subscribe to my blog, then go to my blog and investigate how you can be a donor subscriber. The donor subscribers help to support both the podcast and the blog remaining free and also free of any advertisement. So if you can go and help, that helps to get the news out and helps me to helps to support me as I do this podcasting and do this blogging without any advertising or any income. So I rely on my donor subscribers. And if you can afford that, then I invite you to do so. This 20-part series on the history of the Catholic Church will basically deal with one century per episode. We'll probably end up making it more than 20 parts because as history goes on, things become more and more complicated. And in this seventh episode, dealing with the 6th century, you'll find that things are indeed beginning to get pretty complicated. And if you get confused by everything in this episode, remember that over on my blog, in the church history section, I write a special extended blog post about each one of the episodes. And in that blog post, I list other resources, other links to other podcasts, and I also put down some books and articles and various things that you might be able to you might want to use to go deeper into the study of church history. So I would like to just do a quick review of the episodes so far. In each one of the episodes, I try to highlight or pick out a particular problem that the church faced and then discuss how the church coped with that problem and dealt with that problem under the guidance of the Holy Spirit and divine providence. One of the reasons I'm doing these podcasts is because a lot of people are upset about the state of our world and the state of the church today. And by understanding history, you'll see that all of these things have come up in the past, the different heresies, the different corruptions, the different problems. And the church struggled with these things. And that's why we call the series title is Triumphs and Tragedies, because while there are tragedies in the history of the church, there are always triumphs as well. And the Holy Spirit uses the difficulties, the persecution and the heresies and the corruption to actually bring about the answer and for the church to be able to push forward. So if you remember in the first episode, we basically dealt with the question of historicity of the New Testament. And then in the second, we dealt with the years 100 to 200, from 0 to 100. And this is the time of the Acts of the Apostles when the church is dealing with the crisis of whether the faith should be opened up to non-Jews or not. And it's called the Judaizing question. Should all the Christians have to conform with the Jewish rules and regulations or not? Or what are they? Do they have this kind of freedom that St. Paul talks about? The next episode, dealing with the years 100 to 200, we were looking at the threat of Gnosticism. Gnosticism is a free-ranging New Age age kind of mishmash of different beliefs and philosophies and ideologies and spiritualities. And the church responds to this by having a clear teaching, a clear doctrine, which begins to emerge. And we said that this is the way it is in the world today. New age religion, people who say I'm spiritual but not religious, therapeutic Christianity, Eastern religions, they're all swirling about in the marketplace of ideas, and the Catholic faith offers a clear and a concise and a God-given revelation for clarity in our beliefs. Well, the next episode was dealing with the years between 300, 200, and 300. And this was very much a time of the persecution in the church, when the Roman Empire was persecuting the Christians. And we spoke about how the church responded to that. And the persecution actually strengthened the church, in that those who were weak fell by the wayside, and those who were strong began to be the leaders in the church. And that strength of conviction and the strength of intellect and strength of character helped to build the church's foundation at a very important time. Well, from 300 to 400, the church is dealing with the fact that the Emperor Constantine and his mother are Christian, and there is an edict of toleration which is given, and Christians are no longer persecuted. And the heresy which arose at that time was Arianism, and you might remember Arianism, to put it very simply, said that Jesus Christ was a created being. He was not God incarnate. And the controversy rages back and forth, with Orthodox belief of our Lord being declared at the Council of Nicaea in 325. But then the struggles go back and forth, with some of the emperors actually taking the Arian position and therefore trying to enforce it, and the great hero Athanasius, Saint Athanasius, defended the Nicene doctrine and the Nicene belief against all the Arians, and therefore finally triumphed. The next century, from the 400s to the 500s, was a time when we focused on the heresy of Pelagianism. And Pelagianism is, put very simply, the idea that humans can achieve heaven and achieve salvation without the help of grace. And Saint Augustine is the great character who fights against that, and he's called the Apostle of Grace, or the Father of the Doctor of Grace, if you like, because of his teachings about our dependence on God's grace. So we can see during these first 500 years of the church, therefore, certain things coming into play which build a foundation for the future. It was also in that century that we talked about Pope Leo the Great. The Roman Empire is beginning to crumble by this time, and Pope St. Leo the Great steps in as the Bishop of Rome to try to help the poor and to regain some control and some administrative structures to a crumbling empire, and defend it against the advancing hordes of the barbarians. So that brings us now to episode 7, which is dealing with the 6th century, the years 500 to 600. Again, an awful lot is happening here, and it's very, very interesting to me to see how God's providence and God's direction is working like yeast in the dough, working within history and within the events of history to further his kingdom on earth. And this happens in ways that are unexpected, in ways which come out of the crises that the church is in, and in a wonderful creative way of the Holy Spirit, but doesn't actually, is not something which could immediately be predicted. Looking back on it with hindsight, we can see the currents that were there and why these different developments happened. But when they did happen, I'm sure that no one perceived them as being as momentous as they really were. So we have to understand what's happening in the years 500 to 600, we actually have to go back once again into the century before this, in the 5th century, between 400 and 500, and we have to see some of the things that are happening. First of all, if we go back even further, Constantine, who was the emperor at the beginning of the 300s, he moves his capital from Rome to Byzantium, which he renames as Constantinople. He did so for various reasons. One is that it was more centrally located for the whole of the empire. It was because it was situated on this peninsula and surrounded by water, it was very easily defended. And so he builds his wonderful new capital at Constantinople. But as he does so, the center of the Roman Empire moves east, and therefore the Eastern patriarchs in the church also become more important, and the emperors become their patrons. What happens, therefore, in Rome is that Rome begins its decline. It's no longer the capital of the empire, and it's vulnerable to the invasions of the barbarians who are beginning to press in from the north and from the east. And Rome becomes vulnerable. Therefore, we saw that in the 5th century, Pope Leo steps into the breach and begins to hold things together. So in the 400s, we find that the Goths and the Vandals are moving into Rome from the north. And in the year 410, Rome is sacked for the first time by the Goth leader Alaric. This is a huge shock to the Roman Empire. The old capital has been sacked, and the borders have been breached, and they're losing their territories in Europe as the Goths and the Vandals sweep down from the north. Now, in all of these political and military events, there's also a theological dimension, which gets very complicated, because the Goths and the Vandals had been evangelized in the centuries previously, but they'd been evangelized by Arians. So just because the Orthodox faith triumphed over Arianism in the 4th century, it does not mean that the Arians went away. This continued to be a struggle within the church, so that in the 400s, when the Goths and the Vandals sweep into Rome, not only are they barbarians, but they're not Catholics. They're Arian Christians. And they sweep in, and part of their campaign is to persecute the Catholics. And so we have a strange mixture of Arian Christians who are still semi-pagan in their beliefs and in their practices, and they're sweeping into Rome and about to take over. But at the end of the 400s, a very important event takes place, and that is the pagan Frank from Gaul or from France is King Clovis. And Clovis is a pagan, and he's also one of the barbarians who's sweeping down into Italy, along with the Goths and the Vandals and various other tribes. But Clovis marries Clotilda, who is a Christian princess. And he is baptized right at the end of the 400s in 496. And he calls a council, and he unites the kingdom as Catholics. So the Arian barbarians are pushed back by King Clovis, who's actually Catholic, and brings in the Catholic faith, along with conquering, moving down and conquering parts of Italy. Well, if we move forward with events therefore into the 500s, another very important political and military leader is the last Roman emperor, who is Justinian. Well, they say he's the last Roman emperor. He's the last one who spoke Latin. The exact fall of the Roman emperors completely comes a little bit later, but Justinian is the emperor based in the east. He's the one who builds the great church of Hagia Sophia, which is now a mosque and is still standing. But he dies in 565. So right in the middle of this century we're looking at, in the 500s, Justinian, actually from Constantinople, moves west and begins to reconquer significant portions of the Roman Empire that have been taken over by the barbarians. His generals reconquer the Middle East and part of North Africa, and a good chunk of Greece and Italy, and He also establishes for a time a capital in Ravenna. If you go to Ravenna today, you can see the beautiful mosaics in the church there, in the church of St. Apollinare in Classe, also in San Vitale. And you can see an actual portrait of Justinian and his empress Theodora. I was particularly interested in it because this is where you see the famous mosaic of the three wise men. If you have read my book, The Mystery of the Magi, you realize that this particular mosaic, which was created by Justinian in the 6th century, was very important for helping to identify the wise men as Persians, because they're dressed as Persian noblemen. And this is also where we see recorded their names, Balthazar, Caspar, and Melchior, in this mosaic in the church in Ravenna, created by the Emperor Justinian. And Justinian identified the Magi as Persians because he was following some of the traditions that had grown up within Gnosticism in Persia, in Syria, and in the Middle East where he was located. You can find all of this information, of course, in much more detail in my book, The Mystery of the Magi, The Quest to Identify the Three Wise Men. You can find that on my website, dwightlongenecker.com, or from Amazon online if you're interested in that. Well, Justinian pushes west, and he begins to conquer more of what had been the Roman Empire and push the barbarians back. But remember, these political and military events are always intermingled with the certain theological issues. And this is what's so interesting, is that the emperors are actually taking certain theological points of view. They're writing theological documents. They're getting involved in the debates. They're calling councils of all the bishops to come together and deal with these things. And the particular controversy that that Justinian found himself caught up in was monophysitism. And if you'd like to look up all these different Christological heresies, I encourage you to do so. There will be more about this on the post on my blog to explain about the monophysites and the division that came into the church because of this, again, particular heresy that was linked with a true understanding of who Jesus was. The proper Orthodox understanding of the incarnation is that in Jesus Christ are two natures, divine and human, united in a single person. And the Monophysites were saying that no, it is just one nature, a divine nature, which is there in this human form. And so this seems like a very subtle and a very fine point of theology that we shouldn't really worry about too much. But when you examine these different heresies and you push them to their logical point and find out what the implication is and what it really means, you realize why the fighting heresy is important. Because if Jesus is just a single nature, a divine nature in a human form, then this is an echo of the old Gnostic or Docetic heresy, which had been around several centuries before, saying that Jesus was God, but he only seemed to be human, or Jesus was God, but he was not fully human. And for the redemption of our sins, Jesus really needs to be both God and man. He needs to have the two natures, because on the cross, sin is crucified. Human sin is crucified, and the scriptures teach that he took our sin upon him. He is the second Adam. And if he's not the second Adam, if he's not fully human and fully divine, then there's no sin to be paid for, and there's no power to pay for that sin. And so these Christological heresies actually impact what we believe about sin and redemption and salvation. Therefore, they are important to get right. So Justinian's court is caught up in the Monophysite heresy, and I won't go into more detail about that now, but there will be more on my blog post about this to talk about it a little bit further and clarify it and talk about how it was actually resolved in this particular time period. So let's take a look now and just try to imagine what it was like in the church and in the Roman Empire in this 6th century, between 500 and 600. Basically, there's chaos. The different barbarians, the Vandals, the Goths, up in Britain, the Picts, and the Franks, and the Huns coming in from the east are all making inroads and encroaching on the borders of the Roman Empire. Justinian pushes them back for a bit, but this is only a temporary solution. The Roman Empire is doomed. In 568, it's the Lombards' turn, and the Lombards push south again from the area of Central Europe, and they push south and take Rome. And this societal breakdown means that the urban life disintegrates. So Rome, as the ancient capital, is finally crumbling in on itself, and wars are breaking out between different dukedoms and kingdoms within the Italian peninsula, and the different pagan tribes are invading, and basically there's a breakdown essentially of the urban life. Now, this is very important. The Roman society and the church was initially founded and structured in the great cities of the Roman Empire. So the different dioceses that emerged in the early church were based in the different major cities. We actually see this in the New Testament, where St. Paul writes his epistles to the major cities of the Roman Empire, Thessalonica and Corinth and Rome. These letters to the different churches are letters to the churches in particular cities. Ephesus was another one. And we see that the church life, just like the civil life, is rooted in particular cities. Augustine writes two of his favorite famous book is The City of God, and he begins to discuss this clash between the city of man, which is the city of secular power, and the city of worldly power, and the city of God, which is a spiritual kingdom. And he discusses the interrelationship between city of God and city of man. And this is going to actually emerge in the day-to-day life of the 6th century as the cities begin to break down, urban life begins to break down. And we can imagine what it would be like in our own society if, just take for example, the culture that we live in, which is highly organized and highly structured according to a city, a state, and a federal government, and then an international government. But what if there was a breakdown? What if the infrastructure didn't work anymore? What if there was no money to pay the National Guard, no money to pay the firefighters, no money to pay the police? What if there was no money to keep the utilities going, and there was no money to maintain the city systems of sewers and education and health and safety and all the things that we take for granted? If there was some sort of catastrophe, and the catastrophes in this time period of the 5th and 6th century were not just the pagans invading. The Roman Empire was swept with famine. It was swept with the bubonic plague. It was swept with a disease and disaster in many different ways. And so all of these things combined for the breakdown of the system. And as I said, what would happen in our culture? What would happen in our society if the whole thing just began to unravel and come apart, and over a 200-year period, the cities became desolate, and because there was no work and there was no infrastructure to maintain the commerce and the trade and the jobs. Well, people would become survivalists. They'd head for the hills. They would go out to the farms. They'd learn to grow their own food, and they would learn to also to be concerned with their own safety and their own security, because there was nobody else to look after them. Well, this is what's happening in the 6th century in what was the Roman Empire. As things break down, the culture shifts from being an urban culture to a rural culture. And the church also shifts from being centered as an urban church to becoming more of a rural church. What we're talking about here now is the rise of monasticism. And monasticism, we'll see, is going to take the church through what historians call the Dark Ages. We have to be careful about that term. Certainly, at the beginning of the Middle Ages was a very dark period, which we're going to be entering into now in this the second 500 years of church history. We don't want to call the whole Middle Ages the Dark Ages, because that Dark Age, which lasted for several centuries, also blossomed into Christendom, the great flowering of the Christian faith in the High Middle Ages. But we're, of course, going to come to that later. The foundations of it are being established here in the centuries that we're talking about right now. And this is the foundation of Christian monasticism. To understand its roots, we talked about it a little bit last time, and how the monks began to emerge in the Syrian and Egyptian deserts, and they, in reaction to Christianity becoming the state religion, they were hermits. They were living very ascetical lives. They were very extreme in their teaching and in their ascetical practices, for reasons that we explored in the last episode. But to go back to that time period, what we see developing is very interesting, because these particular characters, like St. John Cassian, is establishing a monastery in France, in Gaul. Another figure from that time period is St. Martin of Tours. He dies in 397, so he's right at the end of the 300s. And as we move into the 400s, and now in today's episode into the 500s, over these this century, we're going to see the development of monasticism in a very interesting way. And a key figure in all of this is St. Patrick. St. Patrick is a Briton. He is born probably in Scotland of Romano-British parents. In fact, the story is that his mother was related to St. Martin of Tours. And St. Patrick is captured by some pirates or some brigands, and he's made a slave and taken to France, where he becomes a shepherd. And he learns there more about French Catholicism, French Christianity. He's a Christian already. And he then escapes from his slavery. He goes into a monastery, learns more about the monastic way of life, and he's then sent back to Ireland to evangelize the Irish. I should say, in that time, in the intervening time, he'd also spent some time in Ireland before going to France. And so he's back and forth during this time period, and he goes back to Ireland to evangelize the Irish. Well, this is the age, therefore, of the great missionary efforts that come not from the East, from Constantinople and from the center of the empire and Justinian, but actually coming from the extreme west of what was the Roman Empire. Patrick is out there in Ireland, and what he finds is that the social structure is not based on the cities and the urban structure like the Roman Empire. Instead, it's based on a rural tribal structure. And he therefore establishes monasteries not in urban landscapes, but in the rural landscapes. And he claims the territory by establishing these monasteries, which are linked with particular rural areas. And so some of the great saints that come out of this are St. Cadoc, St. David in Wales, St. Gildas, and they go out as missionaries. They move east into the areas of Scotland and Britain, and then further on into Belgium and what is now Belgium and France. And they claimed land, they lived as the peasants, they lived a rural life, and they claimed the territories for Christ. This is the great age of Celtic Christianity, and with figures like St. Columbanus, who is influenced by Egyptian monks and goes and founds his monastery on the island of Iona off the west coast of Scotland. These monks are establishing austere monastic eremitical, that's the word for hermits, eremitical communities. Another one which is outstanding is the community on Skellig Michael off the west coast of Ireland. That's the scene, if you're interested, where the latest Star Wars film, where Luke Skywalker retires as a monk, and they have these stone huts built like beehives on this island right off the coast of Ireland, right out in the midst of the sea. It's a harsh and an unforgiving atmosphere and landscape. And this is where the monks went. They went to the toughest areas. They went to islands. They went to mountaintops and established these monasteries, really believing that they were claiming the land from Satan, claiming the land from the devil, and with the help of the angels, they were claiming these areas for the kingdom of God. Saint Columba, who went to Iona off the Scottish coast. Saint Columbanus was another monk during that same time period, who was influenced by the Egyptian monastic tradition. One other really interesting person from this time period is Saint Brendan the Navigator. He dies in around 578, during this 6th century. And there's the legend of Saint Brendan the Navigator is that Brendan went with his monks in small boats that were the hull, which was made of animal skins, of leather, and they set off from Ireland to sail west to the mythical lands in the distant west. And the legend of Saint Brendan is very fascinating, because they returned to Ireland saying that they saw in this mythical land mountains in the sea that were like crystal. And people who want to see this as being historical say, well, that would be icebergs. And then they said there was a moving island which was which would rise up and then disappear, and rise up and then disappear. And people say, well, that would be a whale. They saw a whale as they sailed west. And they come back with these tales of this wonderful land that they visited, which was lush and had inhabitants that they'd never seen before. And therefore, those who believe in the historicity of the legend of Saint Brendan the Navigator say, well, look, in the 6th century, Irish monks sailed to America. Columbus didn't discover America in 1492. It was discovered centuries before by the Irish. Now, recently I came across an article which was very, very interesting, and it was a little detail recorded by a Spanish monk in the 15th century about his visits to North America. And you probably know that the Spanish came to Florida, and they pushed as far north as Georgia, the coast of Georgia, and even South Carolina. And this Spanish explorer records that one of the Native American tribes they met was called the Duhair tribe. And the Duhair were unique amongst the different Native American tribes, because they were tall, they had fair skin, they had gray eyes, and they had red hair. And the Duhair tribe had domesticated deer for milk and for meat, and they were totally unique amongst the Native Americans, enough so that this Spanish explorer made a little note of what they discovered. Well, recently, linguistic experts have been trying to put together the connections between the different Native American tribes to try to discern where they came from and where they originated. And they were not able to find any connections between the Duhair language and the other Native American languages. But they did find connections between the Duhair language and ancient Gaelic, the language spoken in Ireland. So there's an intriguing mystery for those of you who want to explore further. Did the Irish really discover America? And after St. Brendan in the 6th century, did others sail to America and stay here in the States, and in what became the United States? Were they the ancestors of the Duhair tribe, which was then discovered by Spanish explorers in the 15th and 16th century? So this time period is so fascinating about Celtic Christianity and the explorations. We know that the Celts also were Irish, were seafarers, that they went down all around the coast of Britain and even down into Brittany and beyond, down the European coast to Spain. So they were certainly adventuresome seafarers, and the monasticism which they spread was also very influential. Now, at the same time period, we have in the West the development of the huge figure, St. Benedict of Norcia. You might remember that St. Benedict is born at the end of the 400s. So he is a very key figure now in this 6th century, between 5 and 600. And St. Benedict is born in Norcia in central Italy. He has a twin sister called Scholastica. And Benedict goes off to Rome as a young man, as a young student. He's coming from a noble family, and he goes off to Rome to become a college student, and he soon discovers that the college students in Rome, remember, Rome at this time period, at the beginning of the 500s, is decadent and crumbling, and he finds that the students are interested only in pleasure and in sin, and he decides that he's going to drop out of college. So he drops out and goes to learn how to be a monk by living in a cave at Subiaco, which is to the north of Rome, where there was already a monastic settlement. And he learns his basics of being a monk by being a hermit. Eventually, some monks ask him to come and be their abbot, and he says to them, "You don't want me to come because you're already lazy and lax, and I'll be too strict for you." They say, no, we really want you to come and be our abbot. So he says, "You don't really?" And they say, "Yeah, we do." So off he goes, and the legend is that they tried to poison him, and he discerned this and left and shook the dust off his feet and went and founded his own monastery. And this monastery is at the famous Monte Cassino, which is south of Rome in central Italy. And Monte Cassino, of course, was the site of a famous battle in World War II, which you might want to read about. But Monte Cassino, situated right on a mountaintop, was where Benedict established his monastery. And while we think of the monasteries as these great architectural masterpieces and centers of civilization in the High Middle Ages, when Benedict and his brothers went to be monks in the hills of Italy in the 6th century, you have to envision them simply living a survivalist kind of life. They moved to the hills, and they worked as farmers along with the other peasants who were there, doing in Italy really what Patrick and his monks were doing in Ireland and in Britain and beyond. The same pattern is emerging of Christianity moving from the urban centers out into the countryside, into these kind of survivalist monasteries. And Benedict establishes little monasteries of about maybe 12 or 20 men at the most. And his sister Scholastica establishes some for the women. And they're based on six different principles, which I break down and call my Benedict's little trinities. You can hear more of this in my homily, actually, for Trinity Sunday, which is one of the podcasts which you'll find on my iTunes channel, also on my website, called Benedict's Three Little Trinities, Two Little Trinities. And these little trinities, very briefly, are the three monastic vows of stability, obedience, and conversion of life, and the three monastic tools of reading, prayer, and work. And these two little trinities are the cornerstone, the bedrock of the monastic life. Benedict writes his rule, the Rule of St. Benedict is a classic of Western literature. I'm a Benedictine oblate of Belmont Abbey in North Carolina. Oblate simply means a kind of third order Benedictine. And I've been interested in the Benedictine life now for a long time. You might be interested in my book, which is called Listen, My Son, St. Benedict for Fathers. And it applies the Rule of St. Benedict to family life You can find that on my website, DwightLongenecker.com. Just go to the bookstore and you can purchase one there. I'd like to say that donor subscribers of my blog, one of the advantages they get is a 15% discount on all purchases of my books from my blog, from my website. So if you can be a donor subscriber, you'll enjoy one of those benefits. Listen, my son, is a daily book of daily readings. The entire Rule of St. Benedict is there. You read bits of it day by day. And then I wrote a little commentary applying it to family life. So Benedict's Rule is noted, first of all, for borrowing from some of the earlier monastic writings. Remember, by this time in the early 6th century to the mid 6th century, Christian monasticism had already been around for about 150 years or so. And Benedict draws from the rule of St. Basil in the East, and also from the writings of the Desert Fathers, and he constructs his rule. And it's remarkable in many ways because he understands the psychology of human beings. He understands the psychology and dynamic of community life. And one of the noteworthy phrases in Benedict's rule is this little phrase that there should be nothing harsh, nothing burdensome. And he's therefore steering a middle course of balance and a middle course of temperance, trying to avoid the extremes of the monastic life which had gone before. He says, for instance, that a monk cannot be a hermit until he first tests himself in community life. In other words, you can't use the hermitage to run away from relationships and from people. You have to live with your brothers and learn how to live with your brothers before you can go and live with yourself. And there's all sorts of wisdom like that woven into his rule, which combines the liturgical life and the life of prayer with a simple life of work and survival. Now, the other reason Benedict's rule is so important is because he's establishing these communities out in the countryside, and he is not doing missionary apostolic work. The monks stay put. They take a vow of stability that they're going to remain in that monastery for life, for better or for worse. But while they do not have an apostolic work going out into the world, they have a definite call to a ministry of hospitality. Benedict says that every guest must be welcomed as Christ. Now, this is a wonderful insight because the shift is moving in the church from this missionary outreach and apostolic work to the enclosed life, going to a life of prayer and study in the midst of a society which is broken down with corruption and decadence and strife and chaos. And Benedict basically says, right, we can't do anything about these societal problems. We can't solve the decadence and the violence and the immorality and the greed and the selfishness that has broken the Roman Empire. So we're just going to go out to the country and we're going to start again. We're going to start with the building block of society, which is small, tightly knit communities of prayer, work, study, commitment to one another. And led by the Holy Spirit and divine providence, this is absolutely genius. It's absolutely brilliant because this is the only answer to a society that is broken by corruption and greed and immorality. Look at the society around us in the Western world. The Western society is breaking down around our ears. We see the decay, we see the corruption, we see the despair, we see the violence of school shootings and abortion and murder and prison populations skyrocketing. We see all of these things around us, just like in this 5th and 6th century when the Roman Empire was collapsing. And what did Benedict do? He said, we can't do anything about the corruption. And if you've seen the corruption in our society as well, there's no conversation going on between, let's say, those who are in favor of abortion and those who are opposed because it's killing. There's no real conversation. in many ways. There's no real conversation with the breakdown of the family and the immorality and the greed that is in our society, because their hearts are darkened by their greed and by their sin. And so Benedict understands this, and he goes with his brothers out into the countryside, and he rebuilds culture brick by brick, rebuilds a Christian community brick by brick, welcoming anyone who wants to come and join in their ministry of hospitality, but not going out and trying to convert everyone. Instead, they're rebuilding a core which would become a foundation later, as we will see, for this great flowering of Christendom, this great flowering of Christian civilization. Rod Dreher is an acquaintance of mine who has written a very influential book called The Benedict Option. And he basically makes the same point, saying that look at the society around us. The only options what Benedict did, over 1,000 years ago, and to nearly 1,500 years ago, and to do this today, not necessarily going running to the hills and having your own chickens and a pig and growing a long beard and wearing sandals and becoming a sort of back to earth survivalist, but Dreher says no. This basic principle of rebuilding basic core communities, whether it's in your school or your family or your parish, is the Benedict option. To be able to recognize that our efforts to evangelize society will only find limited success. Not that we shouldn't do it, but that it will only find limited success, and our energies should be focused on rebuilding a strongly Christian, strongly spiritual communities of family, of work, of prayer, of reading, of stability and obedience and conversion of life, and to be able to do this in our society. I'm actually a believer in this myself, and I believe that this is the way that eventually a new Christendom will be established. So St. Benedict is this very important figure. He dies in the year 550, just about 7 years after his sister Scholastica dies. And the story of his death is that he is surrounded by his monks, and his hands are lifted up in prayer as he sees the light of heaven and sees all things, and his spiritual life is completed. He has run the course and finished the race. St. Benedict is a wonderful figure, and you can tell by my enthusiasm that he's one of my favorite saints, along with St. Therese of Lisieux. This is the other book I've written about them, St. Benedict and St. Therese, The Little Way and The Little Rule, which studies their lives and their teachings and applies them in our life today. So again, in this 6th century of the Christian Church, we see reflected our own culture, our own struggles at this time period. We see the breakdown of the Roman Empire, and we witness the breakdown and the chaos in our own world, in our own Western civilization. And we learn the lessons from the past, and we say, right, well, let's do what we can to build these core communities of our families, our parishes, our schools. Not rejecting the world as being totally forsaken and evil, but realizing that in many ways we're not going to be able to convert people and win the arguments. And so we will simply get our heads down, roll up our sleeves, get on our knees, and do what we can with what we have where we are. This is Triumphs and Tragedies, a 20-part series on the history of the Catholic Church. I'm Father Dwight Longenecker. I invite you to go and visit my blog, dwightlongenecker.com. Be a donor subscriber if you can. Help to support this podcast. Also, share it with others. Use your social media, Twitter and Facebook and MeWe and other social media, email, to share with others Triumphs and Tragedies, this 20-part series on the history of the Catholic Church. Thank you for listening.
Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
We want to help others, especially in places of strife, such as the Holy Land, where Christianity is dwindling by the day. But how to help? Here's an easy way. Buying products through the Holy Land gift shop. Every product you purchase at myfranciscan.org/shop helps Christians support their families and stay in the Holy Land. Olive wood, embroidery, spices, and many more authentic products from the Holy Land are available right now at myfranciscan.org/shop. The Holy Land Gift Shop, bringing the Holy Land home.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media. Find more about us at breadboxmedia.com.